Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy of DannyRoddy.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and owner of ChrisKresser.com, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, I'm extremely embarrassed, but yesterday was the first time I've ever given blood.
Congratulations. How's your glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity?
I don't know. After a few more times, we'll see how it goes. I didn't have extremely high ferritin ever, mm-hmm. but your conversation with Kopo was enough to get me in there to plan a few more blood draws.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for those of you who didn't follow that on the web, I've been doing a lot of research lately on iron overload because, strangely, I seem to have attracted all of the patients in the world that have this condition. I mean, it's crazy. I would say just, I haven't actually calculated, but I'd say conservatively 30% of the people that I see and, everybody that I see, everyone who comes through the door, I do a comprehensive blood panel on. So it's pretty good. It's pretty good for collecting data. I'd say 30% of people have iron overload, and this means they're storing excess amounts of iron. They either have elevated ferritin alone or elevated ferritin with increased serum iron, increased iron saturation, and then decreased total iron binding capacity or unsaturated iron binding capacity. And it's true that ferritin is an acute phase reactant like C-reactive protein. So it's a protein that's involved in the acute phase response, the inflammatory response. So sometimes elevated ferritin can be caused by inflammation, not iron overload. And it's really important to distinguish between the two. But anyways, I've got all these patients with iron overload. So I started to really do a lot of research, and what I noticed too in my practice was that most of these folks were really glucose intolerant. They really can't tolerate much carbohydrate in their diet at all. And as soon as they start to increase their carbohydrate tolerance, they start gaining weight, or they start feeling tired, have all the symptoms of insulin resistance and hyperglycemia. So then I came across randomly, I don't even remember how, an article written by Anthony Kolpo about how he reduced his ferritin levels because he was having glucose tolerance issues, and that completely reversed that problem. So I corresponded with him a bit, and we traded papers back and forth, and then I dove into the literature, and it was just fascinating what I learned. There's all kinds of papers suggesting that even with people with relatively normal, quote, normal ferritin levels, meaning in the lab reference range, levels of like 150 to 200, in these studies, what they did is through phlebotomy, which is the removal of blood, they would reduce the ferritin levels down into the, 25 to 50 range, which is the levels of a premenopausal female. And these folks who were insulin resistant and had, pretty significant glucose intolerance before that, that disappeared, in the vast majority of the people when they could get their ferritin levels down that low. So that obviously... Go ahead.
Sorry, is it the mechanism just oxidative stress, or what? How is it causing the glucose intolerance?
Yeah, iron is a pro-oxidant, so it does cause oxidative damage and inflammation, and it damages tissue and cells and organs, and namely the pancreas and the pancreatic beta cells. So when you have too much iron, the iron damages the beta cells of the pancreas. It compromises insulin secretion, which would in turn... decrease your carbohydrate tolerance. And there are a bunch of other mechanisms too. Iron overload is associated with, it's one of those things like, when you read the list of symptoms that can be caused by iron overload, it's like, okay, well, maybe you should just make a list of symptoms that aren't caused by iron overload. It'd be a lot easier. But some of the major ones and the ones that I've seen in my practice are hypogonadism, particularly in males. So It's another hidden cause of low testosterone and, you know, issues with male hormone production, because iron damages the pituitary and the whole hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So then, you know, the pituitary can't produce FSH and LH, and then that can't stimulate the Sertoli cells and the Leydig cells to produce sperm and testosterone. So you get male infertility. It's a huge cardiovascular disease risk, iron overload. It's gets deposited in the liver, so it can cause, you know, impaired liver function and even lead to hepatitis or cirrhosis. It has pretty serious effects on brain and cognitive function and mood. It's significantly associated with depression, muscle and joint pain. I mean, every tissue of the body is affected. So it's a really big problem. And interestingly enough, a lot of these papers that I was reading, these researchers are convinced that the difference between the heart disease risk between men and premenopausal women has nothing to do with hormone levels, and it's actually related to iron status. And, you know, a little background on that is that, as I'm sure a lot of you know, it used to be thought that women, premenopausal women, had such a lower risk for heart disease because they had, you know, there was some protective effect of estrogen. And then we know that postmenopausal women have a more similar risk of heart disease to men, and it was thought that that's because that protective estrogen, you know, protective effect of estrogen was no longer happening after menopause. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of you remember they tested this theory out, I think it was back in the 90s, with the hormone replacement therapy trials, the HRT debacle. And the reason it was a debacle is because they gave these menopausal women estrogen, and they had to stop the trial because they were having, you know, twice the number of heart attacks instead of fewer. So these researchers in these papers, and these are, you know, published in major peer-reviewed journals, it's kind of amazing that I'd never heard about it before. These researchers believe that the difference is largely due to iron status, because women, of course, menstruate every month and they lose iron. Because the only two ways to get rid of iron when you have it in your body is through bleeding. So that could be menstruation or phlebotomy, which is the therapeutic removal of blood, or donating blood like you did, Danny. Or chelation, which is taking, you know, chemicals and in some cases some natural substances that bind to iron and remove it from the body. So premenopausal women are menstruating every month. They're losing iron. Their ferritin levels tend to stay low, and their risk of heart disease is low. Whereas men, of course, don't lose blood like that, unless they're maybe mixed martial arts fighters or something like that. But their ferritin levels just gradually tend to increase with age, because they just accumulate iron. And then they end up with higher ferritin levels, and higher ferritin levels are associated with increased risk for diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So I'm going to write a series on it. It's a fascinating topic. I will say that one thing I don't fully understand at this point is, you know, I always try to look at things from an evolutionary perspective, and I'm pretty sure that Grok wasn't going down to donate blood every, you know, couple of months to keep his heart healthy and avoid diabetes. So I'm not sure why iron accumulation would be more of a problem now than it was then, especially considering the fact that, we can imagine that at least some of our ancestors were eating even more iron-rich foods like organ meats than we're eating today. One possibility is that there is a genetic condition called hemochromatosis, where there's a mutation of the HFE gene, and that causes overly aggressive iron storage. People who are homozygous for that mutation have really high levels of ferritin, like over 1,000. and iron saturation of like 95%, and you know, it's I have seen
they're feeling really good.
I have a few patients in my practice with hemochromatosis actually, and one of them didn't have the typical presentation. His ferritin levels I think were only 300 or 400, and that's still actually in the lab range. So this is another example of where the lab ranges fail us, right? Because he'd been, doctor saw that, told him it was no big deal. I saw it, thought it was a big deal. You know, we gave him the gene test, and he did in fact have hemochromatosis, and that's a potentially life-threatening condition. So really important to, you know, pay attention to this kind of stuff. But anyways, this genetic condition causes iron storage. Homozygous carriers usually become aware that they have it if they're getting any kind of regular testing, but they're heterozygous carriers, and then less common mutations of the gene that also probably cause increased iron storage, but not to the degree that full-on hemochromatosis, you know, homozygous carriers have. I'm not familiar with the genetic history of this disease. So in other words, I don't know when hemochromatosis became a more common mutation. I do know that now it's one of the most common genetic conditions in the Western world. In fact, I think it's the most common. Between 1 in 200 and 1 in 300 people have it. So, I mean, that's not super common, but it's not rare either.
I think we can blame Stop the Thyroid Madness for a ton of misinformation on this subject. I don't know if you remember, but that website suggested that anybody exhibiting thyroid symptoms should try to get their ferritin like as high as possible.
Really?
I remember tons of people on that forum just trying to drive up their ferritin.
I never read that.
And I think one of the symptoms for iron overload is hypothyroidism.
You got that, so, right? Because, like I said, if it affects the pituitary and the hypothalamus, which it does, then it's going to tank the thyroid, because obviously the hypothalamus and the pituitary are the upstream regulatory glands that determine, you know, send the message to the thyroid gland of how much thyroid hormone to produce. So, yeah, there's a lot of misinformation out there on the internet. It's my nemesis in a way, because, you know, a lot of patients come to me with all kinds of crazy ideas, and a lot of my work is sort of trying to, you know, re-educate them. And a lot of patients, on the other hand, are really smart and know a lot and have learned a ton from the internet. And so it's a mixed bag, because it's awesome that people can go and learn so much and educate themselves. And, of course, that's how I learned a lot of what I learned. So I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here. But but there is a danger in, you know, like you said, like you read something on the internet and you see a lot of other people doing it or following along, and you think it must be true because there's a lot of people, you know, following along. But unfortunately, that's not really a sufficient criteria to determine something's validity.
You mean that's not a logical fallacy?
I think Anatole France, I think that was his name. One of my favorite quotes is, even if 50 million people say a stupid thing, it's still a stupid thing. Words to live by.
On that note, do you want to get to our first question, Chris?
Yeah, let me just finish by saying, before everyone runs out and starts donating blood every, you know, few weeks, it's important to get a sense of whether your elevated ferritin is due to iron overload or because of inflammation. And also, it's important not to give blood more than, you know, every 55 or 60 days, especially if you're active. Do not plan a high altitude hike on the day that you're giving blood, because you're going to lose a fifth. They take a pint of blood, which is a lot, so it's a fifth of your total blood volume. And if you're sedentary, you might not notice it, but if you're training or you're active, I mean, they're taking hemoglobin and red blood cells out. Hemoglobin delivers oxygen to the tissues. You need oxygen to produce ATP, which is the fundamental energy unit of energy currency of the body. So don't, you know, take it easy the day or two after you donate blood if you're going to do it. And I really recommend working with a qualified, you know, under the supervision of a qualified practitioner with this, because there are a lot of moving pieces. And if it is an inflammatory condition and you're just, you know, removing blood month after month, hoping that the ferritin's going to go down, that's not going to help.
Good advice. Real quick, Chris, do you want to touch on your article that you published today?
Oh, yeah. So I wrote an article today called Another Reason You Shouldn't Go Nuts on Nuts. And this is something I've been wanting to write this or talk about it for a while. I think we actually have talked about it in the past. But so one of the main principles of the paleo diet is that we avoid, you know, food toxins. We avoid eating grains and legumes because of the food toxins they contain. And one of the primary food toxins is phytic acid. And phytic acid binds to minerals in the body and, you know, chelates them. And we were talking before of chelation, you know, in the iron example. And phytic acid, as it turns out, is a pretty effective iron chelator. So, but it also chelates other minerals like calcium. And in fact, you can see in the research that people who eat diets high in phytic acid, like grain-based cultures, have a significantly increased risk of rickets and osteoporosis. So we know a lot about phytic acid. We know that it removes minerals from the body. And of course, that's why in a paleo diet, that, you know, we try to stay away from grains that haven't been properly prepared, especially, and legumes. But one of the things that's often not talked about in the paleo world, I've rarely seen discussed, is the fact that nuts and seeds often have as much or even more phytic acid than grains. And, you know, a lot of people, when they first adopt a paleo diet, are just chowing down on nuts like they're going out of style. You know, they're eating,
who wouldn't?
They're eating handfuls left and right because they're fat. They're a quick snack. They're convenient. They taste good, you know, and a lot of the things that people used to eat for travel snacks and in that sort of capacity are now not available on the paleo diet. And so nuts become a staple food. And I think this is especially true for, like, people who aren't really that motivated to cook, or they're not that familiar with food preparation. And you know, anyone can go to the store and get a big bag of nuts, right? And just come home and chat, you know, just eat them. And they're also, you know, they're small, they're finger food. It's kind of easy to just sit there and eat a lot of them unconsciously. And it's one reason why some people recommend only eating shelled nuts, because you actually have to work at getting at them. But so the nuts thing, I think, is a problem in the paleo community. And I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't eat any nuts at all, because humans can tolerate some amount of phytic acid. You know, I think somewhere in the range of 150 milligrams to 300 or 400 milligrams a day. In the context of a diet that's overall low in phytic acid and high in micronutrients that phytic acid tends to carry out of the body. And there are ways that you can prepare nuts so that the phytic acid content is reduced. And in fact, traditional cultures have been doing this for a long time. You know, Native Americans and Native Californians who ate acorns and acorn meal would only do it after a long period of soaking and rinsing, and then pounding and cooking the acorns and leaving them out in the sun to dry. Other Native American populations who used hickory nuts would parch the nuts until they cracked, and then pound them until they were really fine, and then put the nuts into boiling water and boil them for an hour or longer, and then cook them down into a kind of a soup. So there was really extensive preparation going on. And some, you know, they just knew that intuitively. And it's an amazing thing about traditional cultures and traditional wisdom, because just through trial and error and a lot of experimentation over thousands of generations, they figured this stuff out. And now with modern science, we've confirmed that it's true. So it turns out that if you soak nuts for 18 hours, and then you dehydrate them or dry them in a warm oven, like as low as the temperature can go, around 150 or 170. And then you roast them, probably most of the phytic acid will be removed. But that's a lot of work, and I'm guessing, maybe you can back me up on this, Danny, that about probably 99.9% of people are not preparing their nuts that way.
I would agree with you. I think that's a safe bet. Yeah.
So Elan and I have been doing that for the last few years, like since we discovered, you know, the Weston A. Price Foundation and got into all this a long time ago. And I noticed a huge difference. I used to feel kind of heavy when I ate a lot of nuts, or even a, you know, moderate amount of nuts. And now that we prepare them this way, I don't, you know, that they, I digest them really well and don't notice that. So how many nuts is it safe to eat? I would say it depends a lot on your health status and, you know, your micronutrient status. It depends on, how much omega-6 you're eating, because that's another issue when it comes to nuts. Depends on your total intake of phytic acid from other foods, and it depends whether you're soaking or dehydrating or roasting nuts before you consume them. So in general, what I'd recommend is that for people who are, you know, healthy, a handful of soaked dehydrated nuts, you know, a significant size handful of soaked dehydrated nuts a day is probably fine. But for people who are more vulnerable populations, we could say, like people suffering from tooth decay or bone loss or mineral deficiencies, pregnant women, children who are under 6 years of age, or people with digestive issues or serious illnesses, it's probably best to consume as little phytic acid as possible. And when you do, if you do eat nuts, to limit them fairly significantly and make absolutely sure you're soaking and dehydrating and roasting them before you eat them. And then last thing I'll say about this is one of the issues I've had with the GAPS diet, which I do use with my patients and I think is a great therapeutic approach, I have my own little caveats and tweaks to it. And one of them is that I really discourage the liberal use of nut flour, which is really emphasized in both the GAPS and the specific carbohydrate diet. You know, there's all kinds of recipes for nut flour pancakes and baked goods. And I think, you know, it's because a lot of people who adopt these diets coming from like a standard American diet find it pretty hard to live without grains and legumes and starch or any baked type of, you know, foods when they're accustomed to eating them. And so they just go crazy with the nut flour products. And nut flour, of course, is not soaked or prepared that way, so it would be high in phytic acid. And it's really easy to eat a lot of nut flour, even easier than eating whole nuts. You know, people can take down like several nut flour muffins without a second thought. And that's a lot of phytic acid. Just to give you an idea, 100 grams of almonds has up to 1400 or 1500 milligrams of phytic acid. And I mentioned earlier, the safe range is like 150 to 400. And 100 grams for Americans who are more familiar with ounces, that's about 3.5 ounces. That's a moderate to large size handful. So if you're eating like several nut flour muffins or pancakes or baked goods during the day, you're probably far exceeding the safe amount of phytic acid. So you can soak the flours for 18 hours to try to deactivate some of the phytates, but that changes the texture significantly, and a lot of people find that undesirable. And then
making like gruel.
Yeah, pretty much. It's not your gourmet baked product, that's for sure. And then the last thing I'll say, and sad news, is that coconut flour, which is all the rage in the paleo GAPS community right now, is also has phytic acid. Not quite as much as almond flour, but it's something that you'd want to use judiciously, you know, as a treat, not make it a staple part of your diet. So there.
Everything you ever wanted to know about nuts.
Yeah. All right. Should we answer some questions?
Yeah, let's get to a very simple, simplistic question from Dawn.
I like those.
She asks, do you feel with the right nutrition, the body is capable of healing itself? What do you think? What have you seen in your practice?
Sometimes. Yeah. So I know people are probably getting annoyed with me for saying things like sometimes and it depends all the time, all the time. It's like my stock answer to questions. But it's not a cop out. It's actually true. In some cases, just shifting the diet is enough to allow the body to heal itself and to promote optimal health. In other cases, it's a great start and it plays a significant role in recovering health, but it's not enough. I think an easy way to understand this or to talk about it is using a different kind of physical problem as an example. So let's say you get in a car accident and you shatter your leg in several places, you know, just really, really damage it. And you're in physical therapy. I mean, you get pins put in it. And thanks to the miracles of modern surgical techniques, you're able to walk again. But you probably wouldn't expect to be, you know, running any marathons or breaking any records in the 100-meter dash, right? Like after that kind of experience, you might expect that you'd recover some function, but you may never recover the full function that you had prior to the accident. And I think that there's a similar phenomenon in more functional illnesses. You know, when I say functional, I'm talking about stuff that's not, doesn't necessarily have a structural component, you know, like, you know, autoimmune disease does have a structural component, but let's say something that's not, musculoskeletal. So somebody has an autoimmune disease, which is usually some combination of genetic predisposition and epigenetic environmental factor, and that gets triggered, and then they have Crohn's disease or rheumatoid arthritis or something like that. Absolutely, nutrition is going to play a huge role in managing and in some cases partially reversing and maybe in some cases completely reversing that condition. However, I think there's some damage that's done to the body in that autoimmune attack that may not be reversible only through nutrition, and in fact may not be reversible completely at all. So in my practice with people dealing with those conditions, my goal, you know, we start with nutrition always, and then we see how far we get, and then we then start to address the remaining issues that nutrition hasn't been able to deal with things like botanical medicine or you know, nutritional supplements with a particular therapeutic aim, or lifestyle modification, which would include, you know, particular stress management techniques or particular recommendations for exercise that are appropriate for that person's physical condition and health status. And then I also work with people on how to shift their relationship with themselves and enjoy their lives and their bodies wherever they are in that process. Because the truth is, some people will never regain 100% of their health, and our relationships to ourselves and to our health are just as important, I think, in many ways as our health itself. And this can be illustrated by the difference between people who, I mean, this is interesting. So I have some patients who come in, they fill out my paperwork, and, you know, which has a bunch of questionnaires like rate, you know, how often do you experience this symptom? 0, never, you know, 3 being always. And they're all zeros on the questionnaire. And I'm, you know, I'm looking at it going, whoa, why is this person even coming to see me? You know, they're healthier than I am. But then I get to talking to them and I start asking them questions. And I have learned this over time, you know. I say, so, how's your digestion? Fine. Okay. Well, do you have any gas and bloating? Well, yeah. is it kind of, you know, just occasional or after every time you eat? Well, it's kind of, you know, a little bit every time I eat. Are you constipated? Well, I wouldn't you know, I don't know if I'm constipated. Okay, well, how many bowel movements do you have a week? Usually about three. You know, I mean, it goes like that, honestly. And usually they're men. Men are tend to be a little more tight-fisted around talking about their health. But they actually, they're not suffering in relation to their health the way, you know, in other words, they're at some level of peace with their health. And that there's good things about that and there are not so good things about that. And then there's another subtype that when I open up their paperwork, it's all threes going down. Every single category, every question is a three. Like, I'm like, oh my gosh, this person is like gonna die tomorrow, you know. They're
dying in front of you.
And then I talk to them and they're actually healthier than the previous person that I was just talking about. Like, yeah, on an objective level, you know, they have very few symptoms, but the symptoms they have are just totally, you know, bother them. So I think this is where how we relate to ourselves and how we relate to our bodies and the condition of our bodies is an important thing to pay attention to.
This is interesting just because it kind of connects to the iron overload, but would you say that if somebody had like the perfect nutrition and the perfect diet, but they still had extreme amounts of iron, they could possibly like never quote unquote like heal themselves?
Yeah, that's possible because like I said earlier, there's no way that the body can't get rid of iron unless you bleed or do chelation. So if you've stored up that iron for whatever reason, if it's genetic or some other reason that we don't fully understand yet, then absolutely, because iron damages the tissue. It gets deposited in the tissues and organs, and then it compromises the function of those organs. And then no matter what dietary thing you're doing, you're not going to be able to, you know, diet alone won't be able to deal with that.
Totally. So working with somebody or getting blood tests or working with a competent physician is – If you're dealing with some serious issues, is probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah, I think it's pretty key. And there's a lot that you can do on your own too, of course. But I think getting back to that first question, a lot of people have the idea that nutrition is capable of doing everything, and like it's kind of magic. And I'll be the first to say that I think adequate nutrition can be magic. I mean, we've all, probably everyone listening to the show, I know you, Danny, and I have experienced that. Like, it's incredible the effect that nutrition can have on healing the body. But it's not omnipotent, you know? It's like, it's not all-powerful in the sense that it can deal with any problem that the world can throw at us in terms of physical health. So it's an excellent starting place. In some cases, it can do everything that we need it to do. But in other cases, you know, more other types of interventions are needed. So that's the summary.
Cool. This question is completely related. This one's from Laura. And she asked, in your practice, what do you find to be the biggest barrier stopping people from reaching their optimal health?
Well, I just tweeted out an old post that I wrote called the biggest obstacle to perfect health is your mind. So that's still my answer. And we kind of, we referred to that and then the previous question. In my experience as a practitioner and also in my personal experience in my long journey, recovering my health, what I've noticed is that most of us have areas in our life overall, of course, but specifically in our approach to our health where we go blind, basically. These are areas, I think I called them weak links in the chain in that article. I sometimes refer to them as power shortages. But there are areas where we lack awareness, where we can't see things clearly, where we just don't relate. We just don't relate to them as being a part of an important part of health. So an example of that would be there's tons of people out there on the internet in the paleo world who are spending hours and hours a day on like paleo hacks and you know, Rob Wolf's forums and leaving comments on my site and stuff like that. And they're just like, they can tell you their exact macronutrient ratio down to the percentage, you know, 38% carbohydrate, you know, 25% protein, you know, X percent fat. They can tell you, you know, they're like a walking nutritiondata.com encyclopedia in their head. They'll tell you, they're just like, they know everything about nutrition and everything about their diet, and they're constantly making tweaks. They're going from this diet to that diet, or this supplement to that supplement, and they're just wholly focused on nutrition and nutrients. And there's something to be said for that. I mean, and some people are just intellectually interested in it. I know I am, and I know you probably are, Danny. And so it's like they just enjoy reading about it and talking about it. But there's a point at which I think it starts to become a little bit pathological, and that point is reached when the focus on one part of health happens at the exclusion or the expense of other important aspects of health. So I wrote this series, you know, The 9 Steps to Perfect Health, and the first 4 of those 9 steps deal with nutrition and nutrients, you know, macronutrients, micronutrients, and food toxins and things like that. But the last 5 have really nothing to do with food and nutrients. They're things like managing stress, physical activity, making sure you have enough pleasure in your life, attending to your gut health. And I think those things are, for some people, just as important as nutrition, you know, for the people who've, especially the ones who've already dialed in the nutrition, and in other people, actually more important than nutrition. So, for example, if somebody comes into my practice and they're on a pretty good diet, let's say they're not on a full paleo diet, but they're, you know, they eat pretty whole food based type of diet, but they're an absolute wreck. Like, they're stressed out, they're not sleeping, they're not having any fun in their lives. The first thing I'll focus on with them is not improving their diet. It's dealing with their stress and all of the non-dietary factors, because I think in that case that's actually what's going to produce the biggest improvement. So I think one of the best things you can do for your health is to first identify what your power shortages, if you want to call them that, are. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to just think about the part. If you go through my 9 Steps to Health series, pay attention to which one you just kind of ignore, or you think is stupid or doesn't apply to you, or, you know, that you just discount. And or pay attention to the one that you already know to some extent is an issue for you, but you're just like, every time you try to focus on it, thick wall, you know, blanket surrounds your head, and you just can't focus on it, and you forget about it, and you move on and go back to counting macronutrient ratios. And once you identify what that is, then that's where I think you should really focus your attention. And there's a lot of techniques and ways for doing that, working with challenges and obstacles. But in general, I think starting with really small, achievable goals that aren't going to overwhelm you is a good strategy. So a lot of times people say, yeah, I know I really need to do some stress management, or, you know, try meditation, or try Tai Chi or Qigong, or some kind of, you know, deep breathing or relaxation. And they go, okay, I'm going to do it. So this week I'm going to do an hour and a half of meditation every day. And then they sit down on Monday to do their meditation, and after 5 minutes they're like, this is hard. I can't do this. And so then they stop, and then they don't do it. You know, they don't do it again. So it's way better to say, okay, I'm going to do 3 minutes of meditation every day this week. And for the vast majority of people, that's an attainable goal. And then they do that 3 minutes and they notice, wow, even after 3 minutes, I feel different. I feel a little bit more relaxed and rested, And so maybe next week I'll go up to 5 minutes, and then they go up to 5 minutes. And this kind of incremental method, I think, is the best way of making change, especially when there's some strong, you know, some blind spot conditioning involved.
Good answer. I agree. That is definitely my weak area.
Well, which one?
Stress management, but for a certain period of time, I would listen to relaxation tapes and just kind of calm my mind, and it helped so much. Yeah. And I really enjoyed it. And I think that was actually after listening to the episode with Kurt Harris. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I stopped doing it, but it was amazing, and I really felt great doing it. But I definitely something I kind of lost sight on. And
isn't that weird how that happens? Like, we do something, it benefits us tremendously, we feel good, and then we just stop doing it.
Yeah, I can't
explain. Maybe we'll have a whole show about that sometime, because that's a very interesting psychological dynamic. And I think it's related to very... Oh, let me try to stop that. Hold on. It's related to pretty deep patterns in conditioning, and... I think it would be useful. Maybe it's totally veering away from the normal topic that we talk about, but I have a background in that kind of thing, and I think it might be helpful for people, to discuss more about how to work with really challenging issues. I know for myself, it's having fun. I do a pretty good job of stress management. I've been a long time meditator, and although I have to be honest that, you know, 8 weeks of Sylvie in my life has sort of torpedoed that recently. But I used to be the kind of person that would just always be doing stuff that was really fun, like, you know, going surfing or going out dancing or, going on backpacking trips and things like that. And since I've gotten really, really busy, it's so hard to find time to do that. And even things like just watching a funny movie and laughing, I think, can be so therapeutic for me. And I'm just struggling to find time to do that lately. And I know that it's not good for me and not good for my health. And I'm aware of it, but it's still a challenge for me. So that's my main one.
Chris, I can come over and we can watch Operation Dumbo Drop together.
Right. Sounds good. Just fly up. No problem. All right, so let's go on to the next one.
This one's from K*437. Opinion question: lowish carb, low fat, macronutrients don't matter, or too individualistic? Individualistic.
Yeah.
Go.
I feel like I've talked a lot about this on my blog, so I don't want to. And it's been just like discussed ad nauseum on the internet lately.
Yeah, true.
So I don't want to spend too much time on it. But I'll just give you the basic answer without a lot of elaboration. Absolutely individualistic. Macronutrients do matter, but the extent to which they matter depends on who you're talking about. I think if someone is leptin sensitive and is generally healthy, macronutrients probably don't matter that much. If you look at evolutionary history, we see that humans have a wide, you know, can tolerate a wide variety of macronutrient ratios. You have the Tucacenta in Papua New Guinea, 95.5% of their calories from carbohydrate, primarily in the form of starchy tubers. 95%, you know. So the people who tell you that carbs make you fat, that we would expect the Tucacenta to be morbidly obese, you know, like so fat they couldn't even move. But they're actually really lean and totally free of all modern diseases. And you have, you know, people like the Inuit, traditional Inuit, who eat 80 to 90% of their calories from fat. And, you know, in the conventional view, they should be dropping dead of heart disease left and right, and they should be obese, but they're not. So in that context, I don't think macronutrients matter very much. There's a wide range of cultural variation, and there's a wide range of individual tolerance and variation. Like, I have some patients who feel better on a lowish carb diet. I have other patients and friends like you, Danny, who feel a lot better on a higher carb diet. I myself feel best on a kind of moderate carb diet. So somewhere like around probably 150 to 200 grams a day is my intake. But it also then varies. There are other factors, like in Chinese medicine in school, we were taught that not only is there no optimal exactly similar diet for every different person, that even for one person, there's no optimal diet that would stay the same for their entire life, which I think is a really smart concept, because things like geography, where we live and the climate, seasons, what the temperature and climate is like at any given time of year, our constitution, meaning our genetics and epigenetic factors, our health status, whether we're healthy or dealing with a chronic illness, our goals, like are we training to be Mr. Olympia and we want to put on a ton of muscle, or are we trying to lean out? And our activity levels, are we mostly sedentary, sitting in a chair all day, or are we, ultra marathon runner? Like, all of those things influence what a given individual's macronutrient intake might be at any given point in time. And that might change over time. And it might even change over the course of a day, of a week. Some days, if I know I'm going to be really active or it's a workout day, I might boost my carbohydrate intake. Other days, if I'm feeling like I'm going to be more sedentary, and I just feel like it, I might eat fewer carbohydrates. So I've now totally elaborated when I said I wouldn't, but it's one of those questions that I don't know. It's a thorn in my side, because I'm really tired of people saying you should eat this exact macronutrient ratio. Everybody, I just don't see how that it makes any sense in light of what we just talked about.
Do you think when people subscribe to a paleo diet, the idea that they have to eat what their ancestors ate, which is usually defined as a low-carb diet, do you think that hinders progress in any way? Or do you think that they would usually deem it unacceptable to have higher carbohydrate intakes? Do you think that in any way hinders people from hitting their health goals?
As a totally general rule, I mean, I don't have a problem with somebody eating 400 grams of carbs if that's what, if they're like an athlete preparing for competition, training, and all of those carbs are natural, toxin-free carbohydrates, and that's what makes them feel good and they're metabolically healthy doing that. I have no problem with that at all. So all of these things, I think one of the difficulties is, Danny, that when we're writing books or articles, it's hard not to give people a place to start from.
Totally.
Because a lot of people don't really have experience with self-observation, and it's just helpful to say, hey, this is what works for a lot of people. Give this a shot. But I think, unfortunately, that gets often interpreted as like a rigid prescription that everybody has to follow. And that if somebody does that and doesn't feel good, then they just have to continue doing it, even though it's making them worse. So getting back to your question, actually, Dr. Eads tweeted a study a little while back, and we had a little back and forth about it, because his tweet said, study shows that carbohydrate intake of paleo people was lower than, modern intake. And indeed, it did show that on average, the intake of carbs by paleo people was lower than it is today. But what the study also showed, that there was a huge variation in carbohydrate intake. And so I tweeted that. That's, because that was interesting to me. And it's interesting how, based on our particular perspective, we can use a study to show what, what we want it to show. And he was showing it to say that low carb diets are good for everybody. And I, tweeted back and said, well, actually, the range in the paper was like 3 to 50% for carbohydrate intake. And then there are several quotes in the paper. Let's see if I can't find it. I had it right here on my desk. But the quotes were like, and by the way, for the people that had that range of carbohydrate intake, they were all equally healthy, you know, in terms of the parameters that we were studying. So in other words, that paper showed that macronutrient intake didn't really matter in terms of health, although it was lower in general than macro, you know, carbohydrate intake today. That paper didn't tell us, though, that if what would happen, you know, it didn't tell us about the influence of the type of carbohydrates that people are eating today. So we don't know, for example, that if modern people were eating, you know, 400 grams on average of carbohydrate from sweet potatoes and fruit, would we have the disease epidemic that we have today? Is it, in other words, is it because of the carbs, or is it because of the type of carbs and the food toxins and the carbs that people are eating today? I think it's the latter, and I think you can make a strong argument based on evolutionary, you know, studying other modern hunter-gatherers and carbohydrate ratios like we just talked about. So I have so many things, a series and things I want to write, but I've been reading a lot of paleoanthropology lately, and Kurt Harris turned me on to some good books, and I've been following Hawks's blog. And one of the things that I think is, let's see, how should I say this? I think the understanding of paleoanthropology in the paleo diet movement is somewhat out of date. The idea that, you know, we're 50,000 years ago, our genes were basically the same as they are today. You know, that's often used as an argument for why we should eat only foods that our paleo ancestors ate, that even though things have changed a lot, our genes are basically the same. And I used that argument myself in the past, so I'm guilty. I was wrong. And I've learned since a lot more about genetics and paleoanthropology. So my view has changed, because what paleoanthropologists know is that our genes have actually changed quite a bit in the last 10,000 years. And there have been, you know, it's true that they haven't changed to the extent that we can tolerate, you know, thrive on a completely plant-based diet. I mean, we didn't evolve 5 different new chambers in our stomach and a rumen and, like, you know, and enzymes that help us break down cellulose and all the other food toxins and cereal grains like herbivores and like cows and sheep can do. But we have had significant genetic change, and a good example of that is lactase persistence. So, you know, one of the modern paleo argument against drinking milk is that humans don't produce lactase in adulthood. We do when we're babies, so we can digest breast milk, but as soon as we were weaned, you know, we stopped producing lactase, and therefore we shouldn't drink milk. And that was actually true 10,000 years ago. The skeletal remains show that no adult humans were lactase tolerant 10,000 years ago. But then if you look at skeletal remains from about 6,000 years ago, you see that about 20, and this is from people in Northern Europe, I should say, you see that about 25 to 30% of them were lactose tolerant, meaning they had they continued producing lactase into adulthood. And this is from skeletal remains taken from that same area in Northern Europe. And now today, lactase persistence, or the ability to digest lactose in adulthood, has reached over 95% and up to 100% in some cases in countries in Northern Europe like Norway and Denmark and Sweden and Holland. So, and then of course the population, there's been a lot of admixture genetically. So you've got people who have mixed genetic descent living all over the world. So the range of lactose tolerance is probably quite broad now. And it's not accurate to say that just because we didn't drink milk in Paleolithic times that we can't drink it now. It's, again, much more individual than that. And that's why I've always said that about dairy, that it's good to remove it for 30 days and add it back in and see how you do, because There are a number of different factors, including whether you produce lactase, that would determine whether you can digest milk. So that's one example, but there are a lot of other examples of genetic mutations that have happened in the past 10,000 years, and sometimes even in the past, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 years, that are highly significant and affect everything from how we digest and absorb and process food to our personalities even and IQs, which is that's a whole nother subject. But the point being, there has been a lot of genetic change in the last 10,000 years, and we don't have the same exact genes as our paleo ancestors.
Melissa from Hunt Gather Love had an amazing presentation on this at the Ancestral Health Symposium. So if our listeners get a chance, they should definitely check that out. So Chris.
Yeah, I'd like to check it out.
Go ahead.
I said I'd like to check it out. I'm waiting for them to produce transcripts. I heard that they're going to do that, but I just honestly do not have the time to sit there and watch a video. I can read a transcript in like 1/20th of the time that it takes me to watch the video. So please, whoever is dealing with this, get the transcripts out there.
Yeah, it was amazing. She did an amazing job.
Yeah, I like her perspective a lot.
She's rad. Chris, that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode. Where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
It's chriscresser.com. Let's see. I'm writing the series on low T3 syndrome. I still need to finish up the natural childbirth series. That last article is going to be on the risks and complications of C-section. And let's see. I mentioned in this recent, my last post before the nut one, that we're going to be renaming the podcast. And I asked for ideas, and Danny and I had an idea too. And it looks like it's probably going to be the Health Detective podcast, or the Health Detective Radio, or something like that. What do you think, Danny?
I like it.
Okay. So maybe next time, look out for that. And then just wanted to throw out a quick couple of teases. I'm working on two projects I'm really excited about, and it's too early to say too much, but one of them has to do with weight loss for people who haven't been able to lose weight. You know, people who've tried the paleo diet, they've tried the Atkins diet, low carb, all this other stuff, and they haven't been able to lose weight. It's been, you know, it's a huge thing that comes up in my practice all the time. I've been really working hard, doing a lot of research to try to figure out a strategy that can work for these people. And I've been corresponding, you know, talking a lot with Stefan and with Kurt Harris, and we've all been kind of putting our heads together, and we've come up with something that I think will be pretty effective. And we're going to be doing not a formal trial like what we proposed with Stefan a few weeks back, but just a more informal trial, I think, mostly with my patients. And then, you know, when I'm confident that it works as well as I think it will, then we'll bring it out into the public eye. And then the second is a project. I mean, one of the things I see a lot is confusion about how, you know, what to eat. I mean, there's so many people that are advocating a paleo diet out there, and everyone has a slightly different take on it, including me. And a lot of my patients come to me just really confused. You know, they're like, my head is spinning. Paul Jaminet says eat this, and you say eat that, and Rob Wolf says eat that, and I have no idea what to eat. I'm just paralyzed. And so I have a particular process that I use in my practice to help patients create their own ideal approach, rather than just following a canned prescription, you know, whether it's mine or Paul's or Rob's or anybody else's. And I think that, you know, it's been so successful that I want to make it available to a much broader audience, you know, even people that aren't working with me. So that's exciting. I'm excited about that, and that's going to be ready sometime in the next couple of months, I think.
Please tell me there's some kind of wheel that you spin. or some
absolutely. Yeah. You blindfold yourself and then you throw a dart, and if it hits 50% carbohydrate, that's what you do.
Cool, awesome. You can find all of my work at DannyRoddy.com. Keep sending us your questions at ChrisKresser.com using the podcast submission link. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. Thanks for listening and for your support. Take care, guys.
Thanks, everybody.